So I'm Hélène Landemort. I'm just defending my dissertation on democratic reason, collective intelligence in politics. And so what I'm going to propose here is a sort of follow-up on David Esslin's epistemic approach to democracy, but building also on the insights that have been presented in this colloquium about collective wisdom and collective intelligence more generally, to build a very strong case for democracy. But before I proceed, I would like to start with a question. How much does knowledge play a role in our justifications for democracy? On one view, I would argue that it doesn't play much of a role at all. I mean, at least in democratic theory, most of our justifications for democracy are appeals to consent, equality, justice, fairness, very rarely appeals to intelligence or an outcome-oriented notion. And this is so, I believe, because including all people in the decision process means, of course, including a lot of dumb people. And so intuitively, rule of experts seems more conducive to intelligence decisions. But building on this recent notion of collective intelligence, something we understand only, I think, we have only started understanding it recently, I'm going to try to develop a theoretical comparison between rule of one, few, and many. And I will claim that, first, democracy can be seen as a cognitive system designed to turn the lead of individual inputs into the gold of democratic reason. So here I will rely on some insights from the cognitive sciences to basically look at democracy as a system to think collectively. And the second claim is that when we proceed to compare the epistemic properties, it turns out that democracy epistemically dominates the rule of the few, including the rule of one. And the reason for this is that including more people means including a lot of cognitive diversity in the decision process, and that makes the group smarter. Assuming, of course, that numbers are correlated with more cognitive diversity, but that's an assumption I'm willing to defend, and which is in any way much more plausible than the reverse assumption in many cases. So my talk has three parts. In the first part, I'm going to explain the main concepts that I developed in my dissertation. In the second one, I'm going to go over the two main mechanisms of democratic reason, those two cognitive political artifacts that turn individual inputs into better collective output, and one of which is, of course, very classically deliberation. And the second mechanism, majority rule. Notice here that I combine two traditions in democratic theory, one deliberative, the other aggregative, which usually stand somewhat poles apart. And the conclusion, I will combine the epistemic properties of inclusive deliberation and majority rule with universal suffrage to argue that democracy has an epistemic edge over alternative decision procedures. So the first concept that I propose, and it's not just a fancy word, I think it's a useful label to refer to a certain type of collective intelligence, is democratic reason. And by that I mean the collective distributed intelligence of the people. And here I build on at least three insights from the cognitive sciences. One is the definition of intelligence that defines it as something multidimensional, not just IQ, but general ability to solve problems and figure things out in a context. And collective intelligence, in my view, is nothing more than such a notion of intelligence applied to groups. The second insight I borrow from the cognitive sciences is that it's better seen, this collective intelligence, as an emergent property. So it's not necessarily to be found. It's more than the sum of the parts, if you will. And you cannot necessarily find the ingredients of collective intelligence if you look at individuals only. So you have to take a more systemic perspective. And the third insight is the idea that intelligence, whether individual or collective, can be distributed. So there's a very, very famous study by Edwin Hutchins who describes how intelligence on a military ship is distributed across both the members of the crew and the cognitive artifacts they use, which are compasses, calculators, even norms regulating the interactions between them. So that's one dimension. Intelligence can be distributed across space, can also be distributed across time, as in lists, maps, books, etc. And I think at the level of institutions, I don't see any reason to think that we don't have ways to store some form of knowledge or memory in our institutions. So I'm not going to touch on that temporal dimension here, but I think that would probably connect the notion of intelligence to that of wisdom, something like a learning process over time. But again, I'm going to take a simply very synchronic view here. The term mechanisms I use as a shorthand for political cognitive artifacts. And I only will focus on two of them, but there might be more, of course. It's basically something that takes an input and turns it into something else, arguably better. Finally, cognitive diversity is simply the plurality of cognitive tools that people have. I think we've talked about it before, different frameworks, different interpretations, interpretive models and predictive models and the like. Oh, and a last one, very important one, epistemic competence. By that, I mean something distinct from virtue. So in the comparison between rule of one, rule of the few, and rule of the many, I assume that all rulers are aiming for the common good or are pursuing the common good. As David said earlier, it's I think, a component of any epistemic framework. If you don't assume that, you're already outside of an epistemic framework. And that is, of course, doing a favor in the comparison to idealized dictatorship or oligarchy, because, as Jan mentioned, somewhat structurally, rule of the many is designed to pursue the good of the greatest number rather than that of a minority. Epistemic competence is not information either, and that's where I'm going to somewhat ignore the literature on the uninformed voter here, because I think what they're measuring is an ignorance that is not entirely relevant for the epistemic competence that I'm interested in. Finally, individual versus collective competence. Again, I think one of the reasons why maybe intuitively we think groups of experts are better than large groups is because we think that collective intelligence is a function only of the intelligence of the members. But in fact, it's a function of something else, and actually cognitive diversity of the group. So that means that if you take the linear view of collective intelligence as just a function of individual epistemic competence, then you get this. But if you factor in cognitive diversity, it becomes an increasing convex function, and it's much more. You get much more by adding one unit of individual epistemic competence, holding cognitive diversity constant. You get much more than one more unit of collective epistemic competence. So that's the beauty of collective intelligence, this emergent property. So first mechanism of democratic reason is deliberation, defined very classically as an exchange of arguments, of pros and cons, and ideally leading to a consensus, according to the more recent democratic theory. And the epistemic properties of deliberation are supposed to come from the fact that it enlarges the pool of ideas and information. It weeds out the good arguments from the bad. And again, it leads on the consensus on better solution. I'm not so sure about the third component, actually, because, in fact, in practice, deliberation rarely leads to an absolute consensus. That's the ideal case scenario and the regulative ideal, if you will. But if it already does the first two things, it's already very good, because you narrow down the pool of options, and in which case you can at least proceed to a vote. But if it does, then we have the magic of what Habermas calls the forceless force of the better argument. And one condition of optimal deliberation is, as we've enhanced during this colloquium, the importance of cognitive diversity. And in fact, in the setting of problem solving, which I think characterizes quite well what happens in deliberation, cognitive diversity matters more than individual epistemic competence or individual ability. So that means that you're better off with a random group of relatively smart people that think differently than just a few very, very smart people. This is quite counterintuitive, I think, for most of us. And so here I rely on Scott Page's theorem, Diversity Trumps Ability Theorem, which he didn't mention yesterday because you were focusing on prediction. But I think it's quite an amazing result. So I use it for the case of deliberation, which is about problem solving. And in the paper, I use I'm going to focus on that one example, the case of a jury deliberating. And it's a classic movie that I'm sure many of you have seen, 12 Angry Men, in which a group of 12 men have to decide whether to pass a judgment of guilty or non-guilty on a young Puerto Rican accused of stabbing to death his father. And at the beginning of the play, 11 jurors are convinced he is guilty, mostly because they rely on the testimony of a key witness who allegedly saw the killing. But there is this one last juror, Henry Fonda, who takes them on this long deliberative journey, after which they change their minds. And the beauty of deliberation in this sort of idealized example that it does the three things that I've presented before. It enlarges the pool of ideas and information. For example, contribution of one of the jurors who grew up in the slum is that he knows the proper way to use a switchblade. And proper way to use a switchblade is like this. And the key witness said she saw the killing take place this way. It's already a jarring detail. But it also shows how you can weed out the good arguments from the bad. At one point in the relatively late in the movie, one of the juror thinks of the red marks on the nose of the key witness because he observes the same on the nose of another juror. And that leads everyone to think that the key witness might be short-sighted, which is plausible. She's a 45-year-old trying to look younger, and she wasn't wearing her glasses at the trial. And then the question is, what is more plausible, that she was wearing her glasses in bed while supposedly trying to fall asleep and looking across the window or not? And obviously, here you have the forceless force of the better argument. Everybody has to agree, and that's why they unanimously conclude to acquittal. I'm not going to go over the second example, although I'm happy to talk about it in the question and answer time. The problem, of course, and it's been mentioned before, is the feasibility of deliberation with large numbers. You might think that including more people is better, but then at one point you reach just chaos. Luckily, it doesn't mean we have to fall back onto an oligarchy. It just means we have to find a device to make deliberation feasible, inclusive deliberation feasible, and that's called representation. And a representation is not just an elected oligarchy for the classical reasons. It includes recurrent elections, periodic elections, and also accountability. And in my view, those two things make sure that, in a way, the people as a group or the many are present even in the assembly, if you will, of a smaller group of people deliberating on their behalf. I mentioned also the case of lotteries that could be an alternative to election, because of course election retain a sort of oligarchic flavor. But the hypothesis I'm going to make here, in order not to bias the comparison in favor of democracy, is that actually democratic representation is the goal is not to increase individual epistemic competence of the representatives, but to merely preserve cognitive diversity on a manageable scale, if you will. So that's almost the mirror image view of representation that I'm defending here. So the conclusion should be here that basically inclusive deliberation, whether direct or indirect in representative democracy, epistemically dominates deliberation among the few just because it includes more perspectives and viewpoints. And as we saw, to the extent that cognitive diversity matters more than individual ability, that's the reason why democratic deliberation is a superior alternative, in my view. But again, deliberation doesn't always end up in consensus, so you need often to turn to a second mechanism of democratic reason, which is not so much about solving problems, but maybe deciding which one of the options we've settled on during the deliberation period is the better one. So it's a supplement to deliberation, but it also has its own epistemic properties. And often in the literature, I mean, until basically there was this very this interest in the epistemic dimension of democracy and basically your work, David, I think the thought was that, well, majority rule is just a matter of arbitrating between preferences in a fair way, but it doesn't really ameliorate the outcome. So, of course, now we have a series of theoretical arguments that support the view that it actually improves the outcome, the chances of picking the right answer, sorry. One is the Condorcet-Juré theorem, the other is the miracle of aggregation, and the last one is the crowd beats the average law that Scott Page recently formulated. So I think we've talked yesterday and today about the Condorcet-Juré theorem. I think it's now quite familiar to the field, so I'm not going to go into too many details. I think the main difficulty with this theorem is indeed the independence assumption, which assumes too many signals, that people have access to too many different sources of information in the world, which is not very plausible when we all know that people read the same newspapers, talk to each other, etc. So it's more likely to be highly correlated. The miracle of aggregation, again, I'm not going to go in details about it, especially since the next two speakers are going to explore it, to criticize it mostly. So in the paper, I distinguish between three interpretations of the miracle of aggregation. But the key common point is that errors cancel each other out, that somehow the right answer emerges to the surfaces in the aggregate. The advantage of the miracle of aggregation compared to the Condorcet-Juré theorem is that the average voter need not be epistemically competent at all. In fact, in the elitist version, it's enough that one person in the group knows the right answer, as long as the mean of other people's mistakes is zero. But then we run into problems too here with the question of the rationally irrational voter and the systematic cognitive biases that voters are allegedly subject to. Again, I prefer to postpone the discussion of that point to when we turn to Brian Kaplan's paper. And the other problem, again, like in the Juré theorem, is the empirical implausibility of an infinity of independent signals. So finally, the third theoretical account, which is, my view, the more convincing one, is the crowd beats the average law. And it's the thought that the fact that collective prediction error is lesser than the average individual error for a given collection of diverse predictive models. That means that we are better off using majority rule than picking a random person in the group and letting that random person make the decision. Notice here that here, contrary to what happened in deliberation, cognitive diversity matters just as much as individual competence. So that means that you have a strict trade-off between the competence of individuals and the cognitive diversity of the group. So you can have a small group of very smart people, and they have exactly the same collective epistemic competence as a larger group of less intelligent people. So that, to some extent, doesn't give a real edge to majority rule used with universal suffrage over majority rule used with a smaller number of people, but perhaps the one advantage I see is that it economizes on individual intelligence, so through sheer numbers that reintroduce cognitive diversity. Also, the fact that we don't have to rely on this independence assumption that Surowiecki, the Condorcet-Juré theorem, and the miracle of aggregation assume, because it's only a question of having negative correlations between people's predictive models. So basically, the conclusion that I want to try to defend here is that if you combine the epistemic properties of inclusive deliberation with the epistemic properties of majority rule used among the many, they give an epistemic edge to democracy. And of course, if we now introduce a virtue component that I sort of neutralized at the beginning, it also increases the appeal of democracy because it minimizes the amount of virtue we expect in the rulers. Now, throughout, I made the assumption that there's a correlation between numbers and cognitive diversity. But of course, that can only hold true if democracy operates on the background of a certain type of society, which one could call liberal, namely a society that encourages cognitive differences and maybe that translates into the existence of a free market of ideas, a diverse economy, and possibly a liberal education, fostering autonomy and individuality rather than conformism. So, in a way, what I try to present here is a new story about democracy, perhaps an overly optimistic one, but so far I started thinking I would just assess the epistemic case for democracy, and after studying quite a lot the different pros and cons, I happened to be quite convinced that indeed one of the key added value of democracy is that it really harnesses the power of collective intelligence. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I first to say that I'm very sympathetic with your strong argument, namely that the first one is an epistemic legitimation of democracy. The rule of the many is wiser than the rule of the few. And this is so because of the importance of cognitive diversity for collective wisdom. And I also share your thesis that the collective is something more than the mere aggregation of the individual, or more precisely, that the collective wisdom is an artifact, and as such, is something that more than its individual elements, and therefore that it is important to analyze how this artifact is constructed through the two mechanisms you describe, inclusive deliberation and majority rule. Still, I'm not sure I share all your demonstration in order to demonstrate this thesis. And I have three questions. The first one is about the type of diversity and the type of epistemic competence that the rule of the many can bring. The epistemic quality of the rule of the few is often linked with the alleged superiority of the expert knowledge. Mm. The expert has at least two meanings. The first one, the old one, before the modern revolutions, expertise was an ability which was brought by experience. And with the growing division of labor in the 19th and 20th centuries, the expert is something more. It's a type of knowledge which is opposed to experience and which is systematic and linked to some scientific knowledge. Now consider the rule of the many. What kind of knowledge can bring the rule of the many in the democratic process? A first kind of knowledge is some non-systematic knowledge, with at least two subtypes. The first one is the knowledge based on experience. This is a Dewey paradigm, the shoe, well, the person who knows where the shoe pinches. But there is another non-systematic knowledge, which is a knowledge very often which is brought in the jury or in a consensus conference. The persons have no particular knowledge about the topic and will use only their common sense, leur bon sens. There is a second kind of knowledge, which is the expert knowledge. And also at this level, we could think that the rule of the many can bring something. Because the expertise and the counter-expertise can come from civil society. Say, Greenpeace can bring an expert knowledge, which is useful for the discussion on environment and things like that. And in this case, it's not only where the shoe pinches, but how to mend the shoe, or even how to produce it. And then you have the political knowledge. What kind of knowledge is that? Is that a knowledge which is linked to the common sense, with experience, with systematic knowledge? To some extent, this question about types of cognitive competence or types of knowledge is only a sub-argument in the diversity argument. But this seems to me necessary to further develop the differences if you want to evaluate the various institutional mechanism that foster epistemic competence and collective wisdom. To choose between a citizen jury, a referendum, or an assembly, you have to introduce this diversity. Second question. Does your theory of deliberation fit well with your main argument? I have some doubts about it. I think that we don't have to confuse what Aristotle called deliberation and what the post-Habermasian or post-Rawlsian call deliberation. Your definition of deliberation, even if you said that your third dimension is less important, to enlarge the pools of ideas and information, to weed out the good argument and from the bad, and to lead to a consensus, is a particular definition of deliberation. And I think that there are other definitions which are wider and perhaps better when we look at what takes place in the political process.
Can you give one?
Yeah, I will. More in the line of Anna Arendt, say. Even if we let aside bargaining, deliberation can hardly be reduced to mere arguing. There are other types of discussing in public which are very important for the overall discussion. Take the testimony. Take the expression of social pain, the feeling of injustice. I think that your concept of deliberation tends to reduce deliberation to arguing and tend to exclude dimensions which are important for the epistemic diversity of public discussion. And it's probable that these other dimensions will be more developed within certain social groups, so that it also reduces the diversity of experiences which can be brought in the discussion. And I think we could even make a step further and reintroduce passion as one important dimension for the epistemic quality of citizenry. In a normal case, people tend to be kept within the epistemic limits of what is considered possible or normal in a society at a certain time. And in order to think beyond these limits, to propose to overcome social injustice, the past customs, and so on, patience is very important. I mean, the 68 French slogan, Soyons réalistes, demandons l'impossible, let's be realistic, let's ask for the impossible, was something very important to open the discussion beyond, and this was an argument de passion. But it was important to help to go beyond the present time. Let's consider the women movement in the 60s or 70s. The dissent was very important. So, to restate my second question, isn't it necessary to enlarge your concept of deliberation to really make sense of the contribution of the epistemic diversity of the many? The third question. I'm a bit skeptical with the attempt, very common in political science, to strictly differentiate between independent and dependent variables. In your case, is it wise to put aside the virtue till the end? And wouldn't it have been better to systematically analyze the relation between virtue and epistemic competence in the various problems, and also to introduce another dimension that is not present in your paper, namely the power? I think that power and virtues are important for the discussion itself. Its epistemic quality depends a lot on how the public debate is framed, what kinds of arguments and speeches are considered to be legitimate or not, who are the persons that really may have voice, who influence the others, even in a liberal society, and so on. So in addition, the epistemologic quality of a political system, of a democracy, doesn't rely only on the quality of the discussion, but also on the way in which the discussion leads to a decision and on the way in which a decision is implemented or not in public policies. So the discussion of the many is not necessarily the rule of the many. If you want to demonstrate the epistemic advantage of the rule of the many and make political theory, why is it that you put aside the power in this discussion? Is it a strong thesis according to which democratic reason and power relations have nothing to do with each other? Or is it only a first step in a more global argumentation, but is this step necessary?
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, so the first question was about the type of diversity and type of epistemic competence. And you distinguish between two types of expert knowledge, the ability brought by experience and more classical expert knowledge. Okay, so first of all, this is not something I had time to mention, but it is an empirical question of whether experts do better or can really claim to be experts. So I can mention only one study that I know of. It's Philip Tetlock's work on political judgment. And I don't remember the exact title. I think it's called What is a Good Political Judgment?
Expert political judgment. How do we know?
Yeah. Expert political judgment. How good is it and how can we know? And if honestly, I mean, if what he shows is true, it's quite depressing about the role of experts. And what he shows is that they are largely inferior to statistical regressions, that well-informed laities as groups can do as well. And so we might be living in an age of overestimation, overrating of experts, actually. So that would be one answer. The other answer would be, I am not denying, actually, the necessity of a cognitive division of labor. Because, of course, we were not going to ask people to decide on everything every day. So you need people who are going to specialize and train. But that doesn't mean that the normative source of epistemic authority still isn't in the people who authorized, if you will, those people to train and become experts in a certain domain. So that's why representatives need to be periodically checked and you know, re-elected and made accountable, as opposed to experts that are isolated. Then it raises the questions of independent entities like central banks and the like. Shouldn't they be made more accountable? That's possibly one conclusion that my research would support. And the third answer I would give is that it's really an empirical question. We don't know yet. I think we've failed to experiment enough with democratic reason. We don't know what people are capable of. Because what do we ask from them? That they vote once in a while. We are barely at the threshold of getting their input. I mean, perhaps the first politician who's talked about it, I'm not going to do proselytism, especially since I'm not sure I support her, but we had one presidential candidate whose platform was on that notion of collective intelligence. So it's very recent. But the traditional view is still quite top-down and quite different. So where the people are capable and competent, I think I don't want to be the one who answers that question. I think we have to look, consensus conferences, they showed that people are much more competent than we thought. So how far can they go? I don't know. I am quite optimistic myself. So that's the answer I would give. The second question. Okay, I got worried at the beginning because it said my argument about deliberation doesn't fit with my argument, my general argument. So but then you said, shouldn't you enlarge your definition of deliberation? And I will answer that, yes, I probably need to, but this is a thought experiment. I was trying to, it is a very theoretical, bare-bone view of democracy as rule of the many. And I think most of the time when you complicate the picture too much, you have all those other variables that interfere and you kind of forget. You don't even go as far as comparing things. So I just wanted to make it very minimalist and see how that works. And then, of course, I'm happy to complicate. Notice, though, that when you say, well, deliberation, you don't include power and all the power relations, and that's not the way it works. I'm not doing some kind of Habermasian ideal speech situation. The example I gave you of 12 angry men, for example, involves a lot of power relation. It's a very imperfect deliberative situation, if you think of it. It's a time limited. People don't care, really. I mean, some of them don't care in the group. Some are outrageously biased by racial, prejudices. And still, in the end, it sort of works. So it seems that despite all those obstacles, collective wisdom can emerge. So I'm not denying the role of power. It's certainly a factor I should, make more explicit, but I don't think I'm ignoring it entirely. And finally, so virtue, why do I put it aside? Till the end, it's the same answer. I was trying to simplify and I was trying to simplify in a way that wasn't helping my case, because as I said, I was assuming, as all epistemic frameworks do, which might be a general failure of epistemic framework, but then it's not specifically the failure of my argument, but you have to assume that all rulers rule for the common good. Otherwise, the comparison doesn't work. You already stacked the deck for democracy in a way. So hope I answered.
Okay, I have a whole bunch of questions, so let's try and keep reasonably short. Christian.
Yeah, so you invoke the Condorcet-Drury theorem, the miracle of aggregation, and the crowd beats the average mm-hmm. phenomenon, all as arguments for majority rule. And I think these three should better be presented as arguments for some form of information of opinion pooling, but not necessarily majority rule. In fact, the details of the required opinion pooling mechanism may still differ quite significantly from majority rule. And let me just a few examples why I think even these three arguments may support some opinion pooling arrangement different from majority rule. So for a start, the miracle of aggregation refers to a case where individuals each offer an estimate of some multivalued variable as opposed to submitting a judgment on some binary issue. And now if we look at aggregating estimates of some multi-valued variable, then the natural generalization of majority rule would be the median rule, but not the mean rule. But the miracle of aggregation, in fact, supports the mean rule rather than the median rule. So here already we've got a discrepancy from majority rule. Secondly, if we take the Condorcet-Drury theorem, but we move away from the binary format and look at decisions between multiple options, then there are a number of different ways in which we could generalize majority voting from binary choices to multi-option choices. One would be plurality rule, another would be pairwise majority voting. And which way we go depends very much on the details of how individual competence unfolds in these multi-option choices. And finally, you may very well have a situation in which everybody in the group or society is better than random, but some are much better than others. And in such cases, considerations along the lines of the Condorcet-Drury theorem, in fact, the same underlying mathematical ideas, would support not standard simple majority rule, but they would support some form of weighted majority rule where different individuals are given a different weight, which is a function of their reliability. So specifically, the weight each individual should be given should be proportional to the log likelihood ratio that corresponds to their reliability. So in short, that I think the conclusion here should be information pooling matters, but that doesn't need to take the form of simple majority rule.
Okay. Well, then I would agree absolutely. I focus on two mechanisms, which are the most obvious, because these are the ones we think of when we think of of democracy, right? Deliberation majority rule, and then you can have plurality rule, supermajority, and all things like that. But I thought I would focus on the main traits. And I agree with you with the miracle of aggregation, mean rule, median rule. Yeah, there's some approximation in my use of those technical theorems. But what I would say regarding what you just said about weighted majority rule is that, remember that I'm making an epistemic case for democracy. It's not saying that this is the whole justification. It's one argument, one slice of the justification, possibly. I said nothing about whether this is like the key definitive argument. So there might be non-outcome-oriented or non-epistemic arguments to keep the principle of one man, one vote, as opposed to weighted majority rule, even if there's a loss in a epistemic value at the end. Because it's not all there is to democracy, the value of the outcome. There's also consent justice, but there's been so much done before that I wanted to focus on that more instrumental approach. And then I would ask then, how do we know who has more epistemic competence in advance? It's very difficult, right? You can say, well, it's probably correlated with, diplomas. That would be Mill's solution. You know, we give two votes to the PhD holders. The fact is, again, if I go back to Tetlock, it's absolutely unclear there's this correlation between expertise as it is measured by diplomas. And I don't think I'm a much better voter than, I don't know, my grandmother, honestly. So why would I get two votes? Not necessarily correlated. As long as we haven't established it, I don't see why we can go that far. So that's my answer.
Okay, thanks, Helen. I'm Jeremy Ferris. I'm a doctoral student at Oxford. I have a general puzzle about epistemic justifications of democracy, and that puzzle is if they commit us to or are committed to a particular meta-ethical account of normative truth. So epistemic justifications are reliabilist. They say that P is a justified belief because P is an outcome of a reliable procedure, and a reliable procedures track the truth. Given that this is the kind of justification that we're giving for democracy, I wonder if you think that we can be indifferent to different normative accounts of the truth, or are there some normative accounts of truth that would make an epistemic justification for democracy redundant, or is it a question that we must consider, or that you consider?
I think I understand the first part of the question, but I'm not sure I understand why you think that would make a justification for democracy redundant.
Well,
to assume a certain conception of truth.
No, that's not the claim. The claim is that there might be some accounts of truth that would make an epistemic justification for democracy appear redundant. But the first question is, does an epistemic justification rely on can we be indifferent to accounts of normative, meta-ethical accounts of truth?
Okay.
That's the first worry. And the second worry is, if we can't be indifferent, then there are some that we ought to avoid.
So this first question, that's the question I think all people who defend an epistemic approach face, as David is constantly asked about that. So I don't think an epistemic approach commits you to any particular meta-ethical view, but you can have a thinner or a thicker and culturalist or absolutist conception of what the standard is. So an epistemic conception of democracy is the idea that what we do when we vote, for example, deliberate, we're trying to track a procedure-independent standard. But it's procedure independent. Doesn't mean it's completely independent. Doesn't have to be a Platonician notion of the good or anything like a more realist theory of truth. And it doesn't even have to be called truth. I mean, it's really a semantic battle that I think is a waste of time. But you can call it truth. You can call it the reasonable. You can call it justice, it doesn't really matter. Then if you want to develop that aspect of the to say metaphysical,
it doesn't matter for this argument.
It doesn't matter for this argument, but if you can, you can then, if you want to be an absolute, you know, you could say, well, if you want to give it content, it could be very minimal, like harm avoidance. We want to avoid genocides, political collapse. We want to avoid famines. We want to avoid, this would be the benchmark of what a good decision is, or a good decision procedure is, the extent to which it avoids those bad things. But you can make it more, you can make it thicker, like the pursuit of, the economic growth or education or Pareto optimality. It can have any kind of content in a way. So I'm not committed to any content here. I'm just saying if we posit that there is something like a procedure independent standard, we're better off involving many people in trying to get to it than having just one person. That's all.
Just a tiny follow-up on that question, just because people might be wondering. I think you gave the answer that I would give, too. And in fact, I don't see any reason why this model wouldn't be applicable even to expressivist and non-cognitivist, the sort of most radical anti-realist positions, because they'll still think some things are right and wrong and just and unjust. Yeah. They just have a view about what it means to hold that. So anyway, thanks for your paper. I think it's a very useful thing to bring together all these different kinds of arguments for the epistemic value of democratic procedures. One concern I have is maybe that you could be clearer about the differences between kinds of arguments for epistemic value. So one distinction that I think could be clear, I don't think you're conflating these, but I see a very big difference between statistical arguments for epistemic value, which make no reliance whatsoever on interpersonal discussion, and ones that are deliberative, let's say, which rely on mechanisms of sharing reasons or recognizing reasons that are communicated and so on. So first of all, so when you cite things like diversity, Trump's ability, and so on, it needs to be very clear that that makes no reliance on communication. It has nothing to do with deliberation. It's utterly statistical.
No, diversity in the diversity to Trump's ability.
Oh, sorry, that one is? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Okay. So other of the theorems that Scott was talking about is previous
to... The crowd beats the average.
The crowd beats the average. That's the one I meant. Right. So one thing is to make those absolutely clear. And then once they're made clear, it's a question arises whether things that will enhance collective epistemic value in a statistical way, whether those same factors will or will not enhance the mechanisms that give rise to epistemic value in deliberative contexts. It's really an open question. Unfortunately, there seems to be, now people can correct me here, I know of little or no formal work on what we would informally think of as the 12 Angry Men kind of case or the three deputies. There's a big growing empirical work, literature that tries to study the empirical results of deliberation, and I think I would encourage you to bring to bear some of your insights on that literature. Yeah. As far as formal work, it seems a hard kind of mechanism to build into formal framework.
But
I don't know that paper on it yet. Right, so it's very rudimentary, and the question is, how would the desiderata of these two approaches interact with each other?
Right, well, that's a good question. I don't know. What I do is I juxtapose them. I was wondering, actually, if there's not a sort of wisdom of crowds effect within deliberation if you make it more inclusive of passion, interest, bargaining, and such things. I'm reluctant to do that because I think it just muddies the water to an incredible point. But, for example, one of my advisors, Jen Mansbridge, she thinks that deliberation should be extended to include bargaining and such things because it brings out the interests of the people in a much clearer way. And maybe there's a sort of Hayekian logic within deliberation underneath the argumentative novel layer. But I haven't thought about it much more than that. So thank you.
Okay, my question is more on the same line that one of the previous question on, which is quite evident from an epistemological point of view. What are your standards? I mean, on the face of what standards you claim epistemic superiority of democratic deliberation. And I find the example, the 12 angry men example, quite, I don't know, misleading for my intuitive comprehension, because there is effect of the matter. I mean, there is effect of the matter. This guy either is guilty or not. And also from a more general, very sort of naive point of view, which can be mine, who could accept epistemic justification for democracy? Who are the? I mean, if this is a part of a justification, I mean, you there are plenty of people here who work in a normative framework of justifying democratic procedure. I mean, who are the interlocutors for this kind of justification? I mean, epistemic superiority. Wow. I mean, I won't buy it for any sort of intuitive way of I don't know, perceiving myself as a citizen or as a human being. I don't buy it. This as an argument for a better government. But this can be a sort of resistance that you can convince me that I'm wrong, for example. Well, so... And in general, where do you tap? And another point that maybe I missed: where do you want to tap into diversity? Because you refer sometimes to voters in general, people, or you make an example in your paper about an assembly, you know, so representatives. So where do we want this diversity?
So yes, the comparison with a jury. I think might seem a little bit controversial, but on the other hand, if you think of it, it's a case of imperfect procedural justice, as Rawls would define it. You're trying to approximate a standard that's postulated, but that you can never know when you've reached it or not. I mean, even with the guilty or not guilty case, there's no verification mechanism, really. They don't really know. So it's
can imagine
perfect.
That outside in the world,
yeah, can,
there has been.
You can do that with values as well. You can do that with facts as well. And that's all I'm saying. I'm saying I don't know where it is, but it's somewhere, and we're trying to approximate it. And concretely, it's. I mean, if you take a historical view at democracies, or I'm going to call to my rescue Josiah Aubert, for example, who completed a manuscript on democracy and knowledge, and he's saying. That the if you look at Athens, the flourishing, the successful aspects of it in so many dimensions are probably attributable to its epistemic superiority. So these are very quantifiable, identifiable standards. Economic prosperity, flourishing of the arts, tolerance, I mean values as well. So you can give a name and you can even quantify actually... The standard to some extent. And again, Tetlock tries to do that. Funnily enough, it doesn't shock us when we say, oh, an expert is very good at approximating that sort of standard. There we have no issue assuming there's a standard. But when it comes to groups or people, it's all of a sudden, oh no, it's all about interests. It can't be about wisdom. It can't be about truths, let alone. So I think it's really a mental, it's a paradigm shift that you need to make in order to understand epistemic democracy, epistemic approaches to democracy. And then who could accept epistemic justifications? Then I agree with you. I don't think it's necessarily a good way to go to, you go to a foreign country and you say, look, you have to endorse democracy because it's not the way it's worked historically. It's always been based on appeals to consent, justice, fairness. It's got the intrinsic value of certain of democracy is much more powerful, but I don't claim to
go outside.
Yeah, no. So all I'm saying is that it's interesting. We've got the tools now, so social theoretical tool to social scientific tools to explain the epistemic properties of democracy, and that might explain a posteriori why we kept it, why democracy works so well. Because if the only value that democracy has was lied in consent, equality. And it failed utterly as an epistemic device, then we wouldn't keep it. I don't think so. So that's all I do.
One point you mentioned that when intelligence gets closer to wisdom and collective intelligence gets closer to a collective wisdom, it's when it is a learning process. Mm. And I wanted to ask you a question about that. So I assume that in this learning process, you still stick to your thesis that the many are better than the few. And so I wonder, I mean, if the many are better than the few in a learning process, don't you think it will take a lot of time to educate the people? And therefore, do you think that there should be a time limit, that time is an issue, and what would be your preference in terms of time limit?
That's a good question. I haven't developed that aspect, the temporal dimension of collective wisdom very much, really, honestly. So I don't have a preference right now. I just think that the few, I mean, it might take lesser time for them to improve or get experience and such things, but they are subject to groupthink, and because they're fewer, the problems of lesser cognitive diversity, etc., over time they might actually converge toward the same thinking, the same time of same groupthink faster than a larger group would. So there's a trade-off here, I'm not sure. And then practical considerations are separate from epistemic considerations anyway, so it doesn't necessarily harm the case I just made.
Helene, I think that you are misreading Tetlock, actually. For one thing, he never shows that experts are not better than the public. In fact, the least elite group that he ever compares experts to is undergraduates at UC Berkeley, which is a very elite school. So he compares the elites to people who are perhaps at the 95th percentile of the U.S. distribution. Secondly, he doesn't actually show that elites do badly either, because he limits his sample of questions to difficult and controversial ones. And certainly on questions that are controversial among experts, it is not possible for the average expert to do well, by definition, because they are controversial. So the average must be divided and a substantial number of people must be wrong. And I will say that, this is based upon a review essay that I wrote of Tetlock's book, and he did vouch for it, so I think this is a correct reading of what he's saying. Although he does admit that he might have given people the false impression that experts are not better than the public, but actually he does not think that, and does not show evidence that
okay,
that is
so happening. Maybe I'm over...
So you should read Brian's review.
Yes, I will.
It's a personal favorite. Yes.
I'll pass. Just a quick remark. There's also, as I think Scott mentioned yesterday, the work of Robin Dawes on experts, which is very powerful.
What does he say?
He says that
simple regressions
outperform experts. Mm. Almost.
Yeah.
Always.
In every case. There's been several hundred studies. Mm-hmm. And the experts have yet to win.
Okay.
Just a quick remark about the question posed by David, the connection between what I insist again should be called weak and strong collective wisdom, because that's a clear distinction that it's just exactly the sort that we want, the one with deliberation, what you call statistical. And I think that on the table we have this problem, and I suggest that we set up an international working group to work on this question, and I have some ideas, and I'm sure Scott has, and many people here have. So we should pool our resources to try and make progress on the connection between the two forms of collective wisdom. Now, about Hélène's learning thing, I pick him up a little bit on what Ariel was talking about. It seems that it's true that wisdom has a lot to do with accumulation of experience. Now, what individuals do in the course of their individual learning thing, they're exposed to a number of situations which form their judgment and their perspective. And diversity has a lot to do, as you were saying, with these various takes on novel situations. But where do these different takes come from? They come from the learning set, the set of situations to which the individual learner was exposed. Now, the interesting thing here is that we can go one step above and say that the society or the community is itself learning, but from the experience of its individual learners, members. So there's a learning process. A good collective wisdom thing is a collective learning process that builds on the variety of takes or perspectives that have been, in the first degree, accumulated by the individual learners. And this, there's some formal work to be done here, a formal which is, as always, suggestive of good distinctions, which is that there are cases such as language where, beyond a minimal amount of diversity, all competent learners learn the same thing. But there are other situations, other domains in which this is not the case. And I think typically in political deliberation, we don't have sort of natural kinds and things like language. It's very different. So people have very different perspectives, and there's no convergence. And this is why diversity is important, roughly. I mean, I wasn't entirely clear on this last point.
And just to follow up on what you just said on wisdom through time, etc. Actually, one thought I had is that a third mechanism or an institution, at least, that would store the knowledge accumulated over time would be perhaps constitutions. So that was the thought I had. I never really fully developed it, but John convinced me it was a bad way to look at it, so I just stopped. But
I'll keep it really brief because it sort of follows on from David's point and also some earlier points. It's just coming back to deliberation again. I mean, your slide with the 12 angry men, actually, when I saw that, you sort of said, you know, here's a case where, you know, in other words, the conditions for deliberation appear not to be ideal, and yet the outcome, as you say, we don't really know, was he guilty or not, but the outcome, it's sort of promising in that at least some relevant information was brought to bear on the eventual decision-making and possibly avoid an extreme error. Okay. And actually, when I saw that slide, I sort of saw that as a, obviously an artistic, but an idealized impression of the deliberative process. And that's partly because recently I've come across a sort of review paper by Cass Sunstein. I think others have sort of reviewed evidence on deliberation coming out of sort of experimental setups and a little bit of work in the field. Mm-hmm. And there's some really interesting experimental work which you may wish to cite. You may possibly already do so. I can't give you actual references right now, but I can look them up on my laptop. But there are some experiments where the advantage of it, of going into the lab, obviously, is that you can tightly control the information structure. So you know who has what information, how pertinent that is to, you know, the task at hand, and see how that information comes to be transmitted to the, you know, collective sort of thought process, or perhaps not. And the eventual outcomes are very sensitive to sort of distribution of information, it seems, in the laboratory. So if a minority holds a relevant piece of information, exactly as Henry Fonda did in The 12 Angry Men, then what seems to happen in some experiments is that this person simply doesn't really have an effective voice in the group. And so there are all sorts of biases to which groups tasked with deliberation can become prey, it seems, from some experimental evidence, perhaps also field experiment. I'm far from an expert, but you might want to check out that kind of literature.
No, I did actually. I just completely skipped it in this presentation again because it would have been too long, and also because it's a comparative argument. So I assume that whatever shortcomings of deliberation can happen among the many, they can happen among the few. So, but of course. Of course, you can have groupthink, you can have all sorts of informational cascades and then social influence that stifle, you know, dissenting voices and so forth. But then you need to work on the conditions for good deliberation. And I think the experiments with consensus conferences and other experiments like that, there are ways to bring out the best in people even when they're in a minority and they're not so sure. And so it's working on the perhaps the incentives, the constraints. If you have those things, then deliberation can be good. I'm not saying it's always good.
Sure, sure. And like you say, I mean, David sort of, you know, discussed the difficulties in theorizing, you know, in this sort of territory, and I think that would be an interesting agenda to, for people to pursue, and also obviously then,
but
you know, taking this to data and so
on. I have
on
the feeling that this has been actually pursued like so much already. I mean, the literature is huge on the shortcomings of deliberation. And
right.
The opposite is not so common.
Yeah, but say micro foundations for successful deliberation. I mean, I think that's, you know, sort of. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right, we should stop here.
So we have 10 minutes.